Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
If something is random, then by definition, you're not in control of it. But if some event is not random, what that means is that something has determined it to be the case. Something has made it so that this happened rather than that happened.
There is a semantic difference between being compelled to act and being freely acting. You can look for scientific causes of my actions, and that's absolutely fair enough. But a scientific explanation of an event is one type of explanation.
The only reason you ever do anything is because you want to, in some sense, or because you're forced to. You can choose to do particular things, but when you choose to do something particular, it will be because you want to or because you're forced to. If you're forced to, you're not in control. If you do it because you want to, then given that you can't control your wants, you're not in control of that either.
We have that established already. That's kind of the starting point for where we begin. The question then becomes, where do we go wrong? And I think with philosophy, where we go wrong is that we try to define free will. And so we take it as this abstract concept, and then we think about it, and we think about the concepts involved, and determinism and freedom and all these sorts of things. What do these mean? And then we try and reinsert it back into life, and it doesn't fit. And we go, what's going on there? So we're anthropologists who keep getting the wrong answer.
If a criminal has committed a crime, do you think they're responsible for their actions? And in which case, is a kleptomaniac any less to be punished than just an average thief?
This is the great trouble of free will discussion, is it seems if there's no free will, then what do we do of holding people responsible? Do we just let everybody off for any crime they commit because it wasn't ultimately their fault?
Hello and welcome to the Unbelievable podcast, the show where Christians and non-Christians come together to debate the topics that matter to all of us. I'm your host, Ruth Jackson, and today we're diving into another live debate on free will. Does it exist? What is it? And how do we respond? The show is recorded in front of a packed audience of young people at Wickham High School with the support of Aylesbury Vale Youth for Christ. And I was joined by two fantastic philosophers, confusingly both called Alex. Alex O'Connor, who's obviously no stranger to Unbelievable, studied theology and philosophy at Oxford University and is the host of the Within Reason podcast. He also, as I'm sure you know, has a ridiculous number of views on his YouTube channel at Cosmic Skeptic. Dr. Alex Carter has a PhD in philosophy and is the Academic Director for Philosophy and Interdisciplinary Studies at Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education. This debate was a little unusual for Unbelievable in that both of the Alex actually seemed to agree with each other on many, many points throughout the discussion, but it was a fascinating discussion and it is well worth a listen. Alex O'Connor, would you briefly describe why you don't believe that free will exists? And first of all, if you don't mind just kind of defining the terms, what do we mean by free will and determinism?
Sure, yes.
Just in a few minutes.
I can try my best. And forgive me if I'm a bit sniffly. I'm a little under the weather, and I'm sorry for bringing a sort of viral infection into your school.
They're far enough away, don't worry about it.
I'm not talking about my atheist materialism either. I'm sorry, everybody. Free will is a complicated subject in many ways, but it's also incredibly simple. It's a bit like consciousness in the fact that it's simultaneously the most mysterious, mystifying thing in the world, the greatest mystery that scientists and philosophers have been battling about for centuries and more. But at the same time, the most obvious and straightforward thing in the world because you interact with the world through it. You know what it feels like to freely decide to come to a talk. Perhaps you don't because you're at school. I don't know if you've been forced to be here. But the position that you're sat in, maybe your legs crossed over another, you could choose at any moment to swap them over. And it feels like you have some agency over that. It feels like you're the author of that action, that if I rewound that clock went back in time, you could have done something differently. And you could have done something differently based on your own decision-making, that you could have chosen to do that of your own accord. This is something like what free will is. It's a difficult thing to define precisely, but it's something like the ability to have acted differently if you were to rewind that clock. And the reason that's a troublesome concept for many people is that anything that happens is going to happen for some kind of reason. Now, some people might object that some things might happen for no reason. There might be random events in the universe. Some of the most clever of you might be thinking of quantum physics, where we're told that there's random things happening all the time. You hear this kind of language. One thing to note is that if something is random, then by definition, you're not in control of it. And if something is genuinely random, there's no determinate factor, then you can't be in control of it because it's random. If you had some control over it, it wouldn't be random. So there may be some randomness in the universe. But if some event is not random, what that means is that something has determined it to be the case. Something has made it so that this happened rather than that happened. If I flip a coin, it seems like that's random, and we often treat it like it's random, but technically speaking, it's not. If you could measure the exact force with which that coin was flipped into the air, its exact starting position, you knew the wind conditions, you knew every physical fact, you could predict with perfect accuracy which way it would land. Seems random, but it's not. So what determines whether it lands heads or tails? Well, things like that, things like the force you give to it, things like the wind speed. These things are determining factors into flipping that coin around. Now, my position is that the things that happen inside of your brain are similar to this. Any event that happens inside of your head, that is, the motivation to switch your legs over, or the decision to raise your hand, or to put it down again, these are mental events. It comes from your brain. Your brain tells you to do this, or your brain tells your arm to go up and down. And the question you have to ask of any event, including mental events, is it determined or is it random? If it's random, if your brain just randomly does it, then you're definitely not in control of it because it's random. If it's not random, then it's determined by something. There's something that made you raise your hand. Or maybe it's something else inside of your head. Maybe you raised your hand because you wanted to ask a question. So it's something inside of you. You wanted to ask a question. But then you've just pushed the problem back. And you ask of that mental event, you wanting to ask a question, that desire to ask a question. That itself is either determined or it's random. And again, if it's random, you're not in control of it. The desire just popped into your head and you had no control whatsoever over it. Okay, well, if it was determined by something, then once again, that thing will either be determined by something inside of your head, or eventually you'll go down this chain far enough and it will go somewhere outside of your head. Maybe you wanted to ask a question because your friend whispered in your ear and said, can you ask this for me, you know? And that's what caused you to do it. And if it comes from outside of you, then you're definitely not in control. So if any mental event, it's either going to terminate in randomness, which you're not in control of, or it's going to have some determinate cause, which will either itself terminate somewhere randomly in your mind, or eventually the causation will go so far back that it will go outside of yourself, outside of your brain. I hope that makes some sense. It's a complicated subject, but hopefully we can dig into it a bit more. And I'm sorry, that also wasn't particularly brief, but such is my way with things.
That's okay. I'll cut you off halfway through the next time.
Sure.
You describe yourself, Alex Carter, as a compatibilist. Would you mind just briefly describing what that means and where you stand on free will?
Sure. So I agree with everything Alex just said.
It's not a very good debate so far, is it?
But I also make the claim that there is a semantic difference between being compelled to act and being freely acting, so acting of your own volition. And what we mean by that is not that it's uncaused, but rather that the cause can be roughly designated as myself. Now, what that means is you can look for scientific causes of my actions, and that's absolutely fair enough. But a scientific explanation of an event is one type of explanation. So to borrow Alex's analogy, but to actually connect it with an example that Wittgenstein himself uses, if we see a tree and the leaves are blowing in the wind, in the past we might have said, oh, the leaves are dancing. And now we might say, if only I know the velocity of the wind and the elasticity of the leaves, I can predict exactly how that tree is going to move. But the point is, the second one being true doesn't mean we can't also say the first one. It doesn't mean that we can't also go back to saying the leaves are dancing. The problem is we probably won't say both. So the point is they're compatible because they are meaningful areas of discourse. Now, what gets thrown in my face is often this comment, that's just semantics. Do you know what semantics is? It's what meaning is. So the problem with appealing to, or, you know, rejecting it as just semantics is that you're rejecting the very words that we're using to utter these sentences that we're both using right now. So there's a lovely line by one philosopher who says, yes, that's what free will means, but it's not what free will is. And I said, but the problem is you've just used the term free will twice. You use the same term each time, and that's your problem. You need to be able to explain that. So I totally agree that we can use science to explain events, but I also think there are some things which science can't explain just because it's the wrong tool for that mode of explanation. And the pithy line I have for this is, even if science could explain everything, and there is an if there, because if we just believed that dogmatically, we'd be, you know, we'd be believers in scientism, we wouldn't be scientists. It's not a scientific belief that science will explain everything. But even if we did believe that, it doesn't mean that every explanation has to be scientific. If you ask an English literature professor for an explanation of a particular book, they aren't going to give you a scientific explanation. Doesn't mean it's false. Okay, so that's roughly my position, is that these are compatible modes of discourse, but ultimately we can give them up. And maybe Alex is right, maybe we will.
So Alex, you've got a 20-minute video on your YouTube, which I'd highly recommend you checking out, called Compatibilism Debunked. This might be where we begin to get a little bit of discourse between you. Would you mind just summarising? I mean, obviously it was a 20-minute video and you've got a lot of stuff in there. Why don't you think compatibilism is a viable option when we're talking about free will and determinism?
Compatibilism, there are different kinds of compatibilists, and all that compatibilism is the compatibility between there being sort of, usually determinism is the thing that's being made compatible. So the fact that all actions are determined, that your brain is just doing its thing and there's nothing you can do to change it, that view is compatible with free will. The problem is, and I think the reason that people criticize this is just semantics, that is just sort of defining words in particular ways, is that in theory I can make everything I've just said compatible with free will, so long as I define free will in a particular way. So some people might say, well, free will just means that whatever course of action I take, it originates from inside of myself. It means that it doesn't come from somebody else telling me what to do, it doesn't come from some kind of external factor. As long as it comes from somewhere in my brain, that means that it's free. You can say that if you like, and then yeah, sure, free will exists, no problem. But I think that what people are interested in is more than that. Because if I were to give you some kind of drug that you could take that made your brain do a particular thing, arguably, you know, that came from the drug, but then arguably your brain came from your parents, so ultimately everything is going to be external to you, right? You could say that your brain sort of does something. It comes from somewhere inside of you. But if you don't have control over that, if you couldn't have made it such that that didn't happen, I think that's what people are interested in. So what I think the compatibilist does is says, yes, well, there's kind of no free will, but we can construct this language by which we can talk about the world that it makes sense to include this term free will, and it probably does. And on a practical level, I totally agree. For example, if I were to sort of trip over coming off this stage, and I pushed Alex off the stage, but I sort of fell into him, he fell off the stage, then that would be pretty bad, right? But if I just got up and pushed him off the stage, that feels different. And the thing that feels different is that when I pushed him off the stage, I freely did it of my own accord. And when I fell and tripped, I didn't freely do that. That wasn't my fault. Thing is, on a practical level, this is where it makes sense to say, well, as long as the action originates with me, we'll call it free, because this is really practical. It means that I can hold somebody culpable for pushing someone where I don't hold somebody culpable for tripping up. That's fine. So on a practical level, when it comes to our laws, when it comes to the way that we interact with each other, we can use this free will, and I think people do, they use the term free will to describe something like that, something like your actions coming from within you. But if we're interested in philosophy, if we're interested in what's actually happening, what's really going on here, I would say that I had as much control over either of those actions, because whatever compulsion came over me to get up and push him off the stage, I didn't control it. I didn't bring it about. You know? I mean, imagine it were the case that I did that. I stood up and I pushed you off the stage, and then it was discovered that I had some kind of brain tumor that was pressing up against the part of my brain that deals with rational decision-making and deals with ethical thinking. That I had some tumor growing on it, and that I only started getting up and pushing people randomly once that tumor had developed. Would you think I was less responsible for that? Would you be less angry with me, I mean to say? Would you feel like I'm not as bad of a person if you discovered that the reason why I was pushing people off stages is because I had a brain tumor? And suppose the brain tumor went away and then I stopped pushing people. Would you say it's my fault that I was pushing them off the stage? Maybe not. And why not? Well, because sure, like, I was pushing him off the stage, but it was because of something happening in my brain that I had no control over that made me do it. Well, such is every action we ever commit. Something that your brain does that you don't have any ultimate control over that makes you commit particular actions. So you can salvage the language of free will, I think. But I think it only really works on a practical level. When we talk about free will on a philosophical level, I think the thing that people want is authorship over their actions. They want control. That's what they're interested in. They don't want, you know, anyone here heard of Thomas Hobbes? Does anybody know who Thomas Hobbes is? Very famous political philosopher. And he's one of the most famous early compatibilists. And he thought that freedom is something like being unobstructed by external constraints. And he said, it's a bit like a river being free to run. You know, not impeded by some big rock in its way. The river is free to run down its course. There's a sense in which, on a practical and poetic level, you can say, yes, the river is free to run where it wouldn't be if I put a rock in its way. But on a philosophical level, if I said that that river had free will, I don't think I would be talking much sense.
So the response I would give to that is that I think partly it's a quite reductionist view of what language is, that what we're doing is we're reducing all of meaningful language to what is an accurate description of the world. The problem with that is I think philosophy being both older than philosophy, and older certainly than neuroscience, philosophy is a very old subject, so I would argue the reverse. I would argue that if we're doing it philosophically, we should be talking about, for instance, what were the ancient Greeks talking about when they were talking about free will? They weren't talking about this concept. What was Thomas Hobbes interested in? Probably the same things that many of us are still interested in today, but it is still an older question. He wasn't interested so much in the neurology question simply because that's one way in which we can lose our freedom. Interestingly, Thomas Hobbes supported another way of losing our freedom, namely claiming that we should have an all-powerful monarch controlling everything we do. He had no problem with that, apparently, which is interesting. So there are many ways in which I can lose my freedom or not have freedom. So for instance, a kleptomaniac who compulsively steals is not responsible, and then we make that claim. So is a child not responsible for certain things, but responsible for other things. We might not hold someone responsible because they were under the influence of some particular drug at the particular time. We might not hold people responsible because we think, well, you know, just in that situation, how could someone help themselves? How could someone actually stop that from happening? So my point is, there are lots of reasons why people have freedom taken away. And actually, one of the biggest problems for compatibilists is that they often have trouble showing why we aren't free. So they often defend free will too well. They'll often say, oh, this is what free will is. But then ultimately, you say, but we still deny free will in certain cases. So we need to explain both why some people are free and some people are not free. But there are so many reasons why we say some people are not free that it can't be one reason. It can't be determinism. It can't be scientific explanations. I can lose my freedom because I read a book. And I had this experience. I read Schopenhauer. And he said, we all want to be tragic heroes. But the truth is, we're clowns. You want to be a tragic hero because you want to think you're facing real struggles, really important things. But to be honest, if you actually look at the detail of your life, it's kind of silly. And realizing that, I suddenly almost felt like he was seeing me without my clothes on. It was quite embarrassing. It was kind of, oh, okay, that's far too much to admit for myself. But I almost lost a sense of freedom there. So the point is, I can predict my actions based on what a fictional character does. That's not determinism, that's not scientific, but I would still lose my freedom by saying, I'm only doing this because I want to emulate that character. So my point is, there are lots and lots of ways in which we lose our freedom, and that means that it can't just be this reductivist scientific account of why we don't have free will.
Do you mind if I just, this is really interesting and I want to come back to it. I particularly want to come back to the kind of ethical thing around are prisoners responsible for their actions if we are fully determined. But just quickly, there was something that you've said, Alex, which I'd love to sort of bring in a practical example. You say that we only ever do something because we're either forced to or because we want to.
Yep.
I know you've thrown up various examples like going to the gym and things like that. But for an example, I took my dog for a walk at 6:30 this morning. Mm-hmm. The only thing that was forcing me was like my busy schedule. I certainly didn't want to. So where does that fit in terms of being forced and wanting to?
Yeah. This is important because I agree that trying to explain everything in scientific terms, trying to explain everything in terms of neurology, often misses something important. It's like trying to explain what a poem is by looking at a summary or looking at an analysis of the ink on the paper. You're missing something very important. But you don't need to make a scientific case against free will. You can make a purely philosophical one. Imagine we have no science whatsoever. Let's go back 1,000 years and we're all sat in the same room and we don't know anything about the brain or what it is. And I would just say something like this. You only ever do anything, ever, because you want to or because you're forced to. That's it. There's no counterexample to this. Every single thing you ever do is because you want to or because you're forced to. This seems like a bit of a controversial claim, and that's why I think you bring up this example. So trivially, for example, if I pick up this glass of water and I drink it, it's because I want to, because I want a drink of water. However, you know, I could also be, you know, again, pushed off the stage. I've, you know, moved off the stage, but I was forced to do that. Or maybe somebody holds a gun to my head and forces me to pick up the glass of water, then I've been forced to. I think these are the only reasons you'd ever have for doing anything. So for example, going to the gym, walking your dog in the morning, seems like a counterexample. Well, I didn't want to go to the gym. I was tired. I was feeling very sick. I didn't want to go to the gym, but I went anyway. How do you explain that? Well, why did you go to the gym? Why did you walk your dog this morning?
Because if I didn't, he wouldn't have got walked.
So what?
Yeah, I suppose I want to care for him.
You want to care for the dog, yeah. Right? Like, because you have this desire that your dog is in good health. Now, you have a desire to not walk your dog at 6 a.m, but you also have a desire that your dog be in good health. Which of those desires was stronger?
The desire to look after him.
Why?
Because I like my dog.
But, like, why?
It's a good question.
It just was, right? It was just stronger. And, in fact, had the desire to stay at home been stronger, then that's simply what you would have done. So the thing is...
That was pretty strong, just to be clear.
Yeah, no, I hope so. So, you know, if somebody wants to be healthy, but they're feeling a bit tired, do they go to the gym? Well, what's a stronger desire? What do they want more, to be healthy or to stay in bed that morning? Whichever one they happen to want more is what they'll do. Now, often it's more complicated because there are lots of factors. Going to the gym, maybe it's raining, you want to stay dry, you want to stay in bed, you want to hang out with your friend instead. There's all these different competing desires. And so that means that even when you do something that you don't want to do, it will be driven by some kind of other desire. There's a desire for something that makes you do something you don't want to do so that you can get something you do want, like good health by going to the gym, like your dog's health by walking the dog in the morning, right? So coming to school, for example, some people might be here because although they don't like coming to school, they don't like waking up in the morning, they don't like going to class, they want to get a good job when they're older. And their desire to get a good job is stronger than their desire to stay at home. That would mean you've come here because you want to. Even though you don't want to be here right now, you want something that requires you being here right now. So wants have governed your desire. Some of you might just be here because if you didn't, you know, you'd get detention or you'd be grounded or something. You've been threatened. You've been threatened with something akin to, you know, legal retribution, in which case you've been forced to be here. But those are the only two options. Right? If you weren't forced to do something, and there was literally no reason to do it, suppose you could go to the gym, you don't want to go to the gym, and if you went to the gym, you'd actually only get more unhealthy. And you don't want to be healthy, and you don't care about any of that. You have literally no desire for anything connected to going to the gym. Nobody would go to the gym. I think it's actually impossible for someone to go to the gym if they don't have something that makes them do that, either a want for something or some kind of, you know, forceful factor. So what that means is that the only reason you ever do anything is because you want to, in some sense, or because you're forced to. If you're forced to do it, you're not in control, obviously. If you want to do it, you can say, well, there's free will. That's it. I did what I wanted to do. There's a great line from that selfsame Arthur Schopenhauer, who once said, you can do whatever you want, but you can't want what you want. That is to say, you can't control what you want. Try it out for a moment. Like, you know, does anybody here want to like run a marathon right now? In the clothes you're wearing right now, with no preparation whatsoever. I imagine there'd be some of you. Well, if you do, then you do the reverse. If you don't want to run that marathon right now, I mean, like, I really consider doing it right now. It's a long thing, right? You don't want to do it. Just choose to want to for a moment. It's not the same thing as choosing to do it. Choose to want to do it. Think of someone you really care about in your life. You don't want any harm to befall them. You don't want to hurt them in any way. You want the best for them. Just choose, just for a second, just to want the opposite. Just want them to suffer. It's not so easy, is it? It's not something you can just choose to do, right? So you can choose to do particular things, but when you choose to do something particular, it will be because you want to or because you're forced to. If you're forced to, you're not in control. If you do it because you want to, then given that you can't control your wants, you're not in control of that either. So that's why Schopenhauer says, a better phrasing might be, you can do whatever you will, You just can't will what you will. You know what I mean? I hope that makes some sense.
We're going to leave Alex there for a moment as we've got to take a quick break, but this is fascinating stuff. Alex O'Connor is a true determinist when it comes to free will, and the other Alex, Dr. Alex Carter, is a compatibilist who believes that we can have free will even if our actions are determined by prior causes, as long as we're able to act according to our own desires and intentions without external coercion. If you are enjoying the debate and watching on YouTube, please don't forget to hit the subscribe bell. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please do give us a follow. We will be back in just a moment.
Did you know that this month marks the fourth anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. That's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the second part of today's episode of Unbelievable. We are continuing the debate between Alex O'Connor and Dr. Alex Carter as they explore free will, consciousness, and what it means to be human. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please do follow the show and visit premierunbelievable.com, where you'll find resources, articles, and access to all of our past shows. And you can also sign up for our updates there. Later in the show, we're going to open up the discussion to the student audience for what becomes a lively Q&A session. But for now, here is how the conversation continued. There was a really fascinating line in your PhD research, and it was what Casimir Louis, a philosopher, asked the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, I think that's how you say it. He asked him at the end of one of his lectures, is the feeling of being free a sufficient ground for saying that you're free? That feeling of being free is interesting, isn't it? Because you were saying that while we feel free, we're perhaps not necessarily free. Well, you would say we're definitely not free. So does the feeling of freedom come into it at all?
So I think it does, and I think I can sort of tie it into what Alex was saying as well. So I think one big problem for Wittgenstein in particular around philosophy is that philosophers need therapy. We are very bad with language. We do terrible things with language, and we need to stop doing that. So we need therapeutic sort of redirection. So for instance, everything Alex said is 100% true, but because it's 100% true and everyone already knew it, if I said to you, you know, did you doubt before you came in here that you had a reason for doing the things that you do? Presumably you wouldn't say, oh, no, I don't think, there's always a reason why I do what I do. So the point is, we have that established already. That's kind of the starting point for where we begin. The question then becomes, where do we go wrong? And I think with philosophy, where we go wrong is that we try to define free will. And so we take it as this abstract concept, and then we think about it, and we think about the concepts involved and determinism and freedom and all these sorts of things. What do these mean? And then we try and reinsert it back into life, and it doesn't fit. And we go, what's going on there? So we're anthropologists who keep getting the wrong answer. If I asked you now, for instance, what is a rain dance? I imagine all of you would say the same thing. It's the same thing I was taught when I was growing up, what a rain dance was. It's dancing in order to make it rain. The only reason we think that is because there was a famous anthropologist called James Frazer who went out and saw people doing a rain dance. And he went, look, they're dancing in order to make it rain. What silly people these people are. And then he came home and he went to a birthday party. And he started singing Happy Birthday. And you could imagine someone coming in and going, ha, you're singing Happy Birthday in order to make them older. So my point is this, we make the mistake because we assume that someone's got to have a reason for doing something that makes sense to us after the fact. Most of our freedom exists not because we have our own reasons for doing them, but because we don't have any reason for not doing them. Sorry, I know this is slightly complicated, but the point is that when we talk about free will, we then say, but was the desire itself free? Well, the response is, yes, it was a desire, and I had it, and I didn't not want it. Wittgenstein talks about different degrees of freedom. So for instance, I can stifle a sneeze, but I can't stop a tick if I have Tourette's, right? If I have a certain tick, I can't stop that, but I can stifle a sneeze. So one's voluntary, one's involuntary. That seems too clear cut, because there are also cases where I can just actively do things. I can stand up, I can just do that. So the difference between voluntary and involuntary is too clear cut. We make things too simple. The point is, sometimes I can will to do something. I can try to do something, but normally when I raise my arm, I don't try to do it. If someone asks me a question, what's the capital of France? Hand goes up. I didn't try to do that, didn't try to make it happen. The cognitivist will tell you, oh, there's an explanation going on in your brain. Your brain was doing the thinking. What term of thinking are we talking about now? Thinking that I'm not aware of? If I said, have a thought now, but don't be aware of it, that would also be impossible. So the point is, if you can't actually specify what the explanation is, you're not doing science. You're doing scientism. You're dogmatically believing that there must be an explanation for everything. And we don't know it, let's assume that we know it. And that's not to say the explanation doesn't exist. It's just to say sometimes we just do stuff. And that stuff is free too. We're not just free when we commit crimes that we deliberately thought through. One philosopher, for instance, says, the difference between a kleptomaniac and a thief is that the thief goes through a process of decisive decisions. That's a terrible philosophical argument. What's an indecisive decision? There's a joke, isn't there? I used to be indecisive, and now I'm not so sure. But decisive decisions mean nothing. So the difference between a kleptomaniac and a thief isn't even the process of deciding. Sometimes a thief can just walk past an open van and just take some tools. Were they responsible for that? They didn't decide to do it. They didn't will to do it. They didn't try to do it. They just did it. But we would say they were responsible. And they cultivated that behavior, perhaps. So we could point to their upbringing, we could point to who they are. But these are not scientific descriptions. These are just descriptions of the person now. So my point is we overcomplicate as philosophers. We reduce things down to concepts, and then we simplify them, and we overcomplicate them, simplify them, overcomplicate them, and then we try and bring them back to real life, and they just don't fit. And this is why we then point out things like the principle of sufficient reason. Everything happens for a reason. And we think, oh, then I must not be free. But that's just a mistake that we're making in philosophy, to apply a principle in the wrong place. That principle applies, but Leibniz didn't intend it to be applied in that way.
So drawing on what you're saying there about bringing principles into real life, let's look at that question. If a criminal has committed a crime, do you think they're responsible for their actions? And I guess more importantly, should we be punishing them for their crimes if they've committed them, if they were 100% determined by their actions? And in which case, is a kleptomaniac any less to be punished than just an average thief?
Yeah, well, this is the great trouble of the free will discussion, is it seems if there's no free will, then what do we do of holding people responsible? Do we just let everybody off for any crime they commit because it wasn't ultimately their fault? Well, you asked a second ago, Ruth, if a person is responsible for that action. They are responsible for it in the sense that a tsunami might be responsible for the destruction of a house. Right? There's a sense in which you can say that the tsunami was responsible for the destruction of the house. Was it morally responsible? Well, that would be a silly claim to make, because to attribute moral agency to something that just happened doesn't compute. And so a person is going to be responsible for their actions in that it is them that did the action. The question of whether they should be punished for it, I think, there is, even if you don't consider this free will stuff, even if you believe in free will, there is a very good case to be made that things like prisons should not be based on retribution. It should not be based on the fact that you want to essentially take revenge on someone because they deserve it. That's not why we should be sending people to jail. The reason we have prisons is to deter people from committing crimes and to stop them from committing crimes again. And in fact, in countries where they've trialed a more rehabilitative style of imprisonment, that is, there's one kind of prison which says you deserve punishment and we're going to make your life a misery. There's another which says we want to rehabilitate you into society. We want to help you to transform as a person so you can be more productive. The second type of prison almost always outperforms the first in terms of whether that person reoffends, in terms of the societal stability, all of this kind of stuff. Those kinds of prisons are better. So even without the free will stuff, there's good reason to think that we shouldn't be imprisoning people because they deserve it anyway. So especially when you consider the fact that people might not be in control of their own actions, of course we can still put people in jail. But we do so exactly insofar as it will deter other people from committing those crimes, and exactly insofar as it prevent those people from committing crimes in the future. So they're not there because they deserve it. I mean, think about the fact that, like, it's interesting how this ties into the free will discussion, because if somebody wants to commit a crime, if we threaten them with imprisonment, if we say, okay, you can commit this crime, but if you get caught, you're going to go to jail. Well, they want to commit the crime, but they also don't want to go to jail. Which one of those desires is stronger? Well, guess what? If the desire to commit the crime is still stronger, and so they commit the crime, what does society do? They make the punishment worse. They give them more years in jail, for example. And they'll do that until the deterrent is strong enough that when the criminal says, well, I could go and steal, but then I'd go to jail, and they decide they want their freedom more than they want to steal, and they stop stealing. So what the legal system is doing all along is relying on the fact that people aren't ultimately in control of their actions. They're governed by their desires, and they're trying to erect a desire that's stronger than the desire to steal, that is, the desire not to be in prison. One interesting aspect of this as well, if I can rattle on for just a little bit longer, is the influence that free will has over the other side of the legal system, that is, the judges and the police. There is this wonderful case that I learned about from a great writer called Robert Sapolsky, and he points to this study that was conducted, where they took a bunch of judges. I think they were like parole judges. These were judges who were trying to determine whether or not somebody would remain in jail or whether they'd be granted bail and be able to go free. And they were trying to figure out what's the biggest predictive factor as to whether the judge would let them go or make them stay. How can we know some certain fact about this judge that will help us predict whether they'll let them go or whether they'll let them stay? And they controlled for, you know, politics and the severity of the crime. And you know what they found was the biggest predictive factor that you could use to predict whether the judge would let them go or not? Was how long it had been since the judge had last eaten a meal. The longer it had been since the judge had eaten a meal, the more likely they were to send that person back to prison. And we all know what it feels like to be a bit hangry. But this is because when we think we're acting rationally, we think we're acting in accordance with reasons that we're conscious of, a lot of the time our brain is just doing stuff that we're not even aware of. So, in fact, in this case, if we recognize that people aren't as free as they often think they are, this can actually help our legal system, because it can help us to mitigate against situations like this, where we recognize that I know this judge thinks he's acting totally freely in accordance with his reason and his legal training, but actually he's being governed by his stomach at the moment and he doesn't even realize it. I think that some reflection on the non-existence of free will can help in cases like that.
That's really helpful. You're both philosophers of religion. You do a lot of religious discussion in what you're doing. So if we can sort of slightly flip sideways a little bit, do you think the existence or non-existence of God comes into this at all? Does it determine whether we are determinist, free will? Does it matter? I know you did a whole debate with Ben Shapiro on Unbelievable about this. He believes in free will, and a lot of that was tied up in his belief with God. Do check that out. It's a really interesting debate. But what do you think, Alex Carter, about this?
So just to pick up on some of what Alex was saying as well and bring it round to the religion as well, because I think this is an interesting one, because there's a philosopher called Galen Strawson. I mention his name because it's useful, because P.F. Strawson, his father, he defends free will and Galen Strawson denies free will. I can imagine their barbecues were quite interesting when they go, yeah, who spilled which, and, you know, all the drinks and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, but Galen Strawson talks about the fact that in order to hold people responsible as we want to hold them responsible, they need heaven and hell responsibility. They need the kind of responsibility that carries weight. That lasts for eternity. You know, we damn people. So it's not just necessarily about law courts and this kind of thing. We've grown up, our cultures have developed in line with this kind of absolute responsibility for one's actions. Now, interestingly, I do prefer P.F. Strawson's position. And he also appeals to something similar to what Wittgenstein appeals to, which is that we treat people not so much as having heaven and hell responsibility, but as souls. And what we mean by that is, I'm not of the opinion that you have a soul. I don't believe that you have a soul like a factual thing, like belief in free will. I think both myself and Alex can agree. Free will is not a thing you can have like you have a hand or you have a headache. Free will is a descriptor that it can be applied to you or not applied to you. We just apply it differently. I think that's where our key difference is. But for them talking about souls, what they mean is if I sit in a room with another person, I sit differently than I would if I sit alone. A judge who is judging another person is judging another person. They are still treating them ultimately as a person across the table from them. The fact that we get upset about the fact that it might be down to whether they had dinner recently or not is partly because we're like, oh my, that's getting in the way of treating that person as a person. So even the rebuke, that can't be how you make your judgments, is precisely because there is another side to that coin. It's the meaningful side to that coin that makes us say our ethical lives are what matter. And this is where free will is really most vitally understood, is as an ethical problem. So when I was doing my PhD, someone asked me, why are you doing it? And I realized from the question what they meant was, who are you helping? And I realized, how would I advise a judge? How would I give advice to a judge on whether they should take autonomy away from a patient and force them to have a medical procedure? And my realization was this: if the patient thinks that they're entirely free, they're not. If the patient thinks that they completely lack free will, they're not. If they live in tension, they say, I can see where the doctors are coming from. I do understand their arguments, but this is ultimately my decision. I've got to live with this, and I can see effects on my life going forward. They're free. And that's what I mean by a semantic free will. It exists precisely outside the black and white thing of, does free will exist, does it not exist? It exists in this gray area of semantics, where it's our ethical lives, it's the lives of meaning that we live. It's treating another person as a person. Try and imagine treating another person that you know as a chair, or just a piece of furniture. It's awfully sociopathic, right? It's a terrible thing to try and even imagine. Wittgenstein actually says, if I put a pan on of water on a stove and turn up the heat and it freezes instead of boils, that I can actually make sense of, because I can try it again. I can see what the variables were. But if I walk up to my friend and don't even see them as a friend or even as a person, that brings everything crashing down. It's this basic layer of understanding between human beings that we just cannot get behind. You couldn't give it up even if you wanted to. So Galen Strawson even admits this as well and says, we don't have heaven and hell responsibility. We shouldn't hold people responsible for their crimes, but there's nothing we can do to stop it.
How about you, Alex? Do you think the question of God comes into this at all, or is it irrelevant?
I don't think it helps much. A lot of people will say that, if free will does exist, it seems to be something, like you say, not a property like your hand or something. It seems like this strange, mystical thing that kind of exists more in your soul than in your brain. We're often told that maybe if there's a God, maybe if there are immaterial things, free will sort of lurks somewhere in there. My position isn't just that free will doesn't exist, it's that it cannot exist. Because like I say, that's why I construct this argument of the form, like everything is either determined or it's not. It doesn't matter what that thing is. It doesn't matter if it's a clock ticking. It doesn't matter if it's a rock falling off a cliff. It doesn't matter if it's an atom bumping into another atom or a hand being raised. It does not matter what it is. You don't need to do science. You don't need to do neurology. You don't need to be a chemist. You just need to know that whatever the thing is you're looking at, it is either determined or it's not. Those are the only options available to you. And so when God enters the picture, I don't think it changes very much. One thing I would point out, though, is that because we don't believe in free will, it's important to recognize that we could be totally wrong about this, right? Like, I mean, suppose, for example, that, you know, you were trying to prove the existence of consciousness, trying to prove that there were conscious beings that could see and feel and hear things, right? And I was trying to prove it to you, and somebody said, but hold on, like, the only thing that exists is, like, this brain, right? It's just this, like, brain, it's just, like, atoms bumping into each other. You can close your eyes right now and think of a triangle. You can see a triangle in your head. It's right there. It's got three sides. You can see it in your head. Where is that triangle? Where is it? Well, maybe it's in your head. If it were in your head, then I should be able to cut open your brain and find a triangle in there somewhere. I can't do that. Where is that triangle? It seems to sort of exist immaterially. You can see it in your head right there. So somebody might say, well, this consciousness thing, it can't exist. Because where's this triangle? You're saying that people can smell things. Where does the smell exist? Where, you know, the smell of coffee, where's that? It's not in the coffee, because if there were no nose to smell it, there'd be no sense of the smell. But it can't be in your head either, because, again, like, it's not literally inside your head. I'm not going to open your brain and find the smell of coffee inside of your brain, right? So where's the smell of coffee? Where are these? Where's redness? Where's the imaginary triangle? Where are smells and sights and tastes? And on paper, it makes absolutely no sense that consciousness exists. It makes none. You know, just a bunch of atoms bumping into each other, and suddenly you've got first-person conscious experience. No way, no way. It doesn't make sense. It can't exist. It literally is completely illogical.
Can I come back on that?
And yet, there it is. you're experiencing it, and you know it exists because you experience it. I'm just saying free will could be something a bit like that. Right? It's something that doesn't make any sense whatsoever on paper, but maybe it does still exist. I'm not saying that is the case, I'm just saying it's worth considering. But of course,
just quickly, we have got about a minute before we need to break for lunch, and then we're going to take Q&A. But if you could summarize it in a minute,
that would
be glorious.
I will be very, very quick. So, on graphs, you might have brain states mapped out. Okay, and one philosopher pointed out that if you map consciousness against brain states, you end up with this really weird problem. If I'm scanning your brain whilst I'm talking to you and I say the sentence, at what point do you understand this sentence? I can see every moment of your brain scan. Which part of which brain scan should I look to know when you understood the sentence? You might say at the end, okay, let me give you that last moment again. Full stop, right? That was the end of the sentence. So the point is you needed the whole thing. And this is why science can't understand consciousness or time or anything that is dynamic and doesn't exist in a moment. We think of consciousness like a film. If you hit pause, you get a freeze frame. But that's your brain scan. Your consciousness is more like the soundtrack. What happened to the soundtrack when you pause the movie? It's gone. You can't see it. You can't do anything with it anymore. This is why science can't get at that stuff. So it's not so much mysticism so much as it's not scientific. I can't empirically verify these things.
That is what I'm saying, by the way.
I agree.
It's worth bearing in mind that even if something seems on paper like it makes absolutely no sense. I mean, we've been arguing ad nauseum now that free will can't exist. It doesn't make sense. Your wants, your desires, you don't choose them. All this kind of neurology, determinism. There's no space for free will. And yet we could describe consciousness in the same way. But there's consciousness. You have it. You can experience it right now. So I'm.
Let's agree to agree.
Just very quickly, let's go with you, Alex O'Connor. In 1 minute, why does this matter? Why does whether we're free or determined matter for our everyday lives? Why is it not just a philosophical thing that we can argue about till the cows come home?
Well, it might just be that. There are lots of things that are worth arguing about. You know, do numbers actually exist? Are numbers real things, or are they just like human constructs? Like, it's pretty useful. I mean, who cares, man? Like, whatever. But it's interesting. It's fun. It's fun to think about, you know? How many prime numbers are there? Again, like, you know, it's not really got that much practical import, but it's interesting to think about. So there's that. Of course, it is worth bearing in mind that on a sort of practical level, if somebody wrongs you or does something bad to you, if you can remind yourself that they might not have had control over the determining factors that made them do that, it might make you into a more charitable and kind person. Someone barges past you on the street, or someone is cruel to you, then remembering that they're not fully in control, at least fully in control of the action that they committed, will make you into a kinder person, a more forgiving person. It will help you to understand people better, and I think that's a worthwhile thing to embody.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Related to that, Wittgenstein has a beautiful image where he says, the ethical life is the one where you can hold up as the most number of pictures that make sense. So for instance, if you want to hold someone responsible, you've probably got before your eyes the image of them at a crossroads making a choice. A choice itself is a kind of metaphor, an image, right? I can prove that, you know, if you go to a party and someone comes up and they're holding, oh, you chose the sausage roll, did you? Oh, I didn't see anything else. I didn't realize, well, the choice was there. Was it? Because I didn't know about it. So again, this goes back to the question is, does choice or want or desire exist for me or for everyone? But the point is, you might hold up this image of a choice and say that's why they're responsible. He says, on the other hand, if you're not inclined to hold someone responsible, you might be holding up the image of someone falling down a mountainside and saying, how could someone help themselves in that situation? And Wittgenstein says, when you're inclined one way, hold up the other image. When you're inclined the other way, hold up the other image. This was my point about living in tension, being comfortable with the idea that we can't know the answers to these sorts of questions, and we're not supposed to know. We're supposed to live with the tension between those two things. So in the middle of this debate, perhaps, is where the meaningful stuff is to be found.
We are going to be heading to the Q&A very soon, but just a quick reminder to check out the rather spicy debate that Alex O'Connor had on this very topic with the legendary talk show host Ben Shapiro. We'll make sure that we include a link to that show, and we will be back in just a moment. This is the final part of today's Unbelievable with Alex O'Connor and Dr. Alex Carter discussing free will. You are about to hear both of them answering questions from our audience of young people, and we'll start with a question for Alex O'Connor. He was asked by a student, what are the ethical implications if there is no free will?
So, Alex, where does the kind of ethical motivation come into your questions of either being forced to do something or wanting to do something? So if she wanted to murder someone, but had an inclination that it was wrong, what would you say about all of that?
It's a great question, of course. I think that if the law didn't exist, or at least that law didn't exist, the only considerations would be what you want to do absent of the law. So you want to murder someone, you probably have some reason for that. Maybe it's just the thrill of murdering someone. Maybe it's someone you really don't like. You'd have some reason to do that. But like you say, we seem to have these like moral intuitions that tell us not to do that. I think that... So if you think about why the legal system exists, why it was invented in the first place, we had a bunch of people going around murdering each other, and then collectively as a society, we realized that society would be much more stable if we had a legal system that tried to stop people from doing that. That's why it got invented. Before that happened, I think that biologically, our genes sort of did the same thing, but they did it with these things that we call moral intuitions. So on an evolutionary trajectory, those societies, those organisms, which have some kind of like inexplicable desire to not murder each other, to not like when people murder each other, that kind of thing, to have a very specific emotion that like makes you not like that kind of thing happening, and therefore less likely to do it, and more likely to be angry when other people do it, will make that society more stable. For the same reason that like inventing a legal system that stops people from murdering each other makes society more stable, evolution building into us some kind of natural predisposition against murder, I think, leads to a more stable society. And so I think that's why it evolved. And so I think you would just be left with this intuition that exists in you for whatever reason. I think it evolved, as I say, for that reason, because it leads to a more stable civilization. Organisms are more likely to survive if they have some kind of rules against that kind of stuff. And that's what gives you this desire. But it's a desire like any other. It's a desire like being hungry for food or being tired and desiring sleep. The desire for like ethics, I think, is a kind of desire. It's a very specific kind of emotional desire that evolution has driven into us, if you see what I'm saying. I don't know if that makes sense, and I also don't know if that really answers your question, but I think it would just be a competition of desires still, and the desire not to murder, the ethical desire, would just be one of those desires.
Is that something, Alex Carter, where you think God could come into that, in terms of placing that ethic inside of you?
I suppose God comes in specifically more to explain where the historical development came from, because I would disagree with Alex that it came about because we wanted stability. I think we had legal systems, whether we would call them that today, in place well before anyone was interested in stability. I mean, they might have been interested in not having their stuff poached from their land and that kind of thing. But I don't think it came about as a stability measure. We might have that now. I think that's probably our motivation now. But I suppose with ethics and moral intuition, yes, there is the idea that... Henry Sidgwick, who I'm researching at the moment, a Cambridge moral philosopher, he actually tried to pull out of an atheistic group, a free-thinking group, because he was worried that he was being too influenced by a kind of divine will. He thought, well, this moral intuition that I can sense is behind some of this stuff. And he was getting part of this from Kant. So Kant has the view that the Christian golden rule of treat others as you would wish to be treated was okay, but not perfect. The perfect version is treat others as you would wish others to treat others. So it was more dispassionate, less self-interested. It's still not perfect, by the way, but nonetheless. But that moral intuition that we have, it's seated biologically, psychologically, etc. But the problem I have with that kind of explanation is, for instance, I often hear students say, we can explain why people believe in God in psychological terms, just as we can explain why people do good in psychological terms. But presumably we can explain why people do psychology in psychological terms. It doesn't mean they go away. It just means you've offered an explanation for them. To give you an example, Freud said that laughter is the release of nervous energy, to which we're some, but why do we release nervous energy? It doesn't explain anything. So it's just giving a new name to it. So I have concerns about calling, you know, it kind of moral intuition a psychological thing, because it's just an ill fit. It's like there is a concept, there are psychological motivations that we should talk about, but I don't think you can reduce moral intuition to that. Moral intuition is just a bit of a richer or slightly different concept. Does that make sense?
That's a really good question, thank you. So there's two parts to that. One is the herd mentality, and one is the inaction versus action when it comes to this question of, are you forced to do something or do you want to do it?
Yeah, I mean,
Inaction is a kind of action, in the way that not speaking is a kind of speech. It sort of can be treated in the same category, right? So like if I can pick up the glass, I can also not pick up the glass. And both of those are sort of branches in the future that are available to me. And one of them being inaction, it feels more inert, but it's still an available course. So an available course for me would just be to sit in this position and never move a muscle again for the rest of my life and die of starvation in this chair. That would be kind of inaction, but it's like, it's a direction that's open to me. Right? And so although it feels like I don't choose to do that, it's more like I'm choosing to do nothing. In a sense, it's still, I'm choosing that line. I'm choosing that course of inaction. And so the bystander effect is very interesting. I mean, people tend to, if you see a crime in front of you, a lot of the time people don't call the police or call an ambulance because they kind of presume that somebody else is going to do it. Anything else? Surely, like, if it's kind of like when the fire alarm goes off and everyone just sort of goes, like, you know, it's the fire alarm. You know what you're supposed to do, but you don't move because you're kind of waiting for somebody else. And you think, well, surely if it was serious, somebody would be doing something. But then you are that somebody, right? And so, like, I think, again like, with the free will thing, like if you don't act because you think somebody else is going to act, think somebody else is going to do that. Again, it's just sort of your brain weighing up your desires. Well, you kind of want to stand up and go because the fire alarm's going off, but you don't want to be awkward if it's actually just a drill and you somehow like missed the memo and didn't understand and you look like an idiot. So you're sort of weighing up these desires. And again, it's just a question of which one's going to be stronger. Yeah, that's interesting, right? So the fact that we can predict what somebody is likely to do or believe based on their community. We know the kind of family that someone's born into, the kind of country that someone's born into. We can predict with pretty good accuracy maybe what their religion is going to be, certainly things like the language they're going to speak. And so, although in a sense we want to say, well, we have some freedom over this. Oh, sure, like I grew up in this culture with a particular religion, and so I'm likely to belong to that, but I could choose to do something else. The fact that you're even slightly more likely to do one kind of thing than another, just because you're sort of part of a herd, is interesting. Because when you push that to its fullest conclusion, I think it turns out that everything is like that. Right? Like if you do something and you realize that, well, the reason you acted in a particular way was because of something to do with your upbringing. I think that's true of everything. Right? Maybe you don't get out of bed in the morning and you're always told off because you're lazy. I'm a pretty lazy guy, you know, I sleep in a lot. And it's sort of like, yeah, okay, well, yeah, maybe I am a bit lazy, but did I choose to be lazy? I'd rather not be lazy. I'd rather be one of those people who can wake up at 6 in the morning and walk their dog. You know, I'd really like that kind of life. I just, my brain isn't that, and why is that the case? Oh, maybe it's because I wasn't disciplined. Maybe because when I was at school, I didn't put enough effort into cultivating the kind of personality. Well, so it's my fault. But then hold on, why didn't I put the effort in back then? Like, why not? Oh, because, you know, I didn't care to. I didn't care about school that much or something. But then why not? Like, I didn't get to choose any of these predispositions. I didn't get to choose how lazy I was. I didn't get to choose if I'm the kind of person that wakes up in the morning or not. It's not something that I'm in control of. And so in the way that, like, you can look at the fact that someone's a part of a herd and think, well, they might only be doing that because everyone else is doing it. I think that's what's going on in all human behavior. You're only doing that because of your upbringing, otherwise you could take somebody with the same upbringing, the same parents, same genetics, the same house, the same schooling, the same teachers saying the same thing in exactly the same way, run the whole thing back. Everything is the same. Every word that person hears, every person that person interacts with, everything remains exactly the same. And yet that person, one time when you run it, turns into, you know, a French-speaking Christian, and the next time you run it, turns into an Arabic-speaking Muslim. I think it literally doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense to me, you know?
Non-conformity is very conforming. For instance, Goths all dress the same. Flat earthers all get together and have a convention, right? There's conformity and non-conformity as well. Interestingly, is 100% psychological as well. You can take people and throw them in a room of all different nationalities, and whichever nationality is the most populous, everyone will just, without deciding to do this or being aware of it, will all stand the same distance apart. And it will be whatever the national average distance you stand apart for the nation that is the most populous. So if you've got 14 British people in a room of 50 and it's the most populous group, everyone will stand the British distance apart, which, by the way, is the furthest apart. If you then throw in 20 Argentinians, everyone will stand the Argentinian distance apart, which is the closest. And they'll just do this over time. They'll just start to conform in that way. And even if you became aware of it, you'd just be one of those people who's aware of it so that they don't conform, which is exactly what everyone who's aware of it is doing. There's a thing called the pocket profit, going back to the free will thing. There's a lovely analogy. I can never find the paper that it was in, but I remember reading it when I was an undergrad. And it would tell you what you're about to do. And if you show it to someone else, it's saying exactly what I'm saying right now. And it's a, Alex holds out his arm and holds up a phone and says the sentence and blah, blah, blah. And then if I look at it myself, it would just go, error. Because it can't possibly tell me what I'm about to do, because I'll just do something else. So there is this problem of the kind of reducibility of it, because again, you always end up with that existential perspective. And this is where I think perhaps you might find some hope, because existentialism talks about existence preceding essence. So before I'm a nonconformist, before I'm a conformist, before I'm a human being, before I'm a... But the problem with that is they always sneak a little bit of metaphysics in there. So you've got Jean-Paul Sartre saying that a hiker who succumbs to fatigue has chosen to do so. Come on. I mean, that seems a bit too much. But he's, you know, oh, you're blaming the fact that you've got no electrolytes and no water left in your system, so that's just bad faith. That seems a bit mean. So I don't think we can get around that particular difficulty, but I certainly think that there's more to the question once you start introducing existential awareness. Oh, and one last thought, sorry, mediopassive. So there are things that happen to us and there's things that we do, but mediopassive is a lovely tense that the Greeks had in their language, where they would talk about things that you do and are done to you at the same time. Getting married is a good example, right? Because it's something I'm doing, but it's being done to me. Hopefully I'm choosing to do it as well. So there are examples of behavior that is mediopassive, that I am, like Archimedes getting in the bath and having his eureka moment. He didn't intend to have that moment by getting in the bath, but it did have to happen to him. So the idea struck him. He didn't strike upon the idea. I can't choose to have my best idea ever. It has to come to me, but it has to come to me. It'd be weird if someone else found the answer to my problem in their head. So there's something mediopassive about what we're talking about, I think, as well.
The question was, do you think that consciousness is a thing?
Yeah, so I actually do think it's a thing. The point I was trying to make is that it seems so much like it shouldn't exist. It seems like if you try to explain it in terms of atoms and brains and this kind of stuff, the consciousness, you'd be like, well, where does that fit in? It doesn't make any sense. And yet I do believe in consciousness. I think it exists. I think it's impossible to deny, because like I'm using it to even consider the possibility of its falsity. And so the point I was trying to make is that free will might be something a bit like that, which just sounds like it doesn't make sense whatsoever when you try to write it down, when you try to explain it. But maybe it still does exist in a way that we can't even comprehend in the way that consciousness does. Maybe that totally undercuts your question, sorry. But I do believe in consciousness, yes. I mean, the way that the brain works, we were talking a lot about like raising our hand, for example. And it's really interesting if you try to pay attention. Like, you know when you're like walking along the street, you're not paying attention to like all the bodily movements, right? But if you wanted to, you could say, okay, well, let me pay attention. Well, my heel's touching the floor, then rolling, then I'm pushing off with my toe. You could like be conscious of it, of how it's all working. But think about like moving your finger, right? Like if I look at my hand right now, you can try it yourself. You can look at your hand and you can tell your fingers to move. I can like tell my finger to move. I'm desiring it to move. I want it to move. I'm commanding it to move, and it's not doing anything. How do I move it? I just sort of do it, you know? It's not like I'm commanding it, it's not like I'm telling it, I'm trying to do that right now and it's not moving, it's disobeying my order. And yet I just sort of do it. So how do I do that? Well, if I try and pay attention to the actual mechanism by which that's happening, in the way that I was, you know, doing with the walking, it's still a complete mystery. I have no idea, how am I doing that? You know what I mean? It's sort of like that scene in the first Spider-Man film where he's trying to work out how to shoot the web, and he's like, go web. He's trying to like command it, he doesn't have to do it, and he realizes that he just sort of has to just do it, right? There's something so bizarre about how consciousness works like that. You know, the actual mechanism by which that finger is moving is a complete and utter mystery to me. I have no idea how I'm doing that.
But, can I throw out, you know? An interesting example. So there was a woman who discovered that she can't feel pain at the age of 67. So she used to go when she touched a hot stove. She can't feel pain. She has a condition that means that she cannot feel what we would call pain. Now, many people would say that proves that the pain is in your head. Well, how does it? Because she was reacting like she was in pain. So I think so much of this is a kind of feedback loop, that what we're calling our, you know, we think that thoughts are private first, public second. I would argue it's the other way around. They're public first, private second. Which causes a problem for intellectual property rights, because it means that ideas weren't yours to begin with, they were someone else's, so you're sort of stealing them from the commons and then saying they're mine. But I think this is an important question that I think is fundamentally shifting how we have to think about consciousness. And there was that bet David Chalmers made with a computer scientist who said, we're going to have a conscious AI in 10 years. That was 10 years ago. He lost the bet because David Chalmers was right. Consciousness is too much of a hard problem to solve. And I think it's a hard problem for the reasons that I said, that it's you can't pin it down. You can't use science to sort of break the moment and find the bit of consciousness that's sitting there. It doesn't work that way. And again, that's not a fault of science. Science isn't meant to be able to do those things. It's its strength.
Just as we finish, I'm aware we've touched on some really heavy stuff and it's some quite deep philosophy. Where should these guys go if they want to get into philosophy, maybe not study at uni, but just want to delve a bit deeper into philosophy generally, but also this topic in particular?
It's tricky to say, because we have been sort of, it's been a bit sort of complicated at times, and possibly also quite boring if it's a particular part of a conversation that you're not interested in or maybe aren't following. There are so many resources online. There are just so many of them, and it depends what level you're at and what level you want to be at, right? Like, if you go onto YouTube and type in free will debate, you're going to find hours and hours and hours of usually public level content, and you'll know how good it is based on like how many views it's got. It's sort of self-selecting, because the stuff that's really interesting and exciting is going to be more widely shared and more widely viewed, and so you'll be able to watch that. I would really recommend just going on YouTube, looking at that level. If you want something a bit more serious and studious, depending on where you're at, there's this great online resource called the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. It's a big old encyclopedia of philosophy, and it is wonderful. It has entries on everything you could possibly want to know about, written by experts. It's a bit like Wikipedia, but each entry is edited, is written by a single individual. It's got, well, sometimes multiple authors, and it's a wonderful resource. I always point people there. The reason I hesitate is because it depends what level. Sometimes it can be a little bit complicated and wordy, but you know, I'm sure that at least some of you here will appreciate that. I'd go there.
Great, thank you. Anything to add?
I agree, and all I would add is say, when you find philosophy you like, when you find problems that you like and philosophers that you like, lean into them. Start reading them more, go into them more, because you'll find so much more interesting stuff there, and you'll start to see the debates that exist between people who read that philosopher differently. And I think if you start to do that, and I do think studying is great. I will just do a shout out for the Institute of Continuing Education where I work. We're like the Open University for Cambridge. You would be amazed. We're cheaper than the Open University, we're cheaper than most other places. You can study undergraduate philosophy at Cambridge for less than you think, and you do not have to have an A level in philosophy. It's totally open entry. So these are courses that you can take alongside your work in the future life, or it could be something that you do alongside your undergraduate studies. We have some people who do it alongside their degrees. Again, you don't have to do that, but it can provide that level of discipline when you're required to submit an essay and you'll get feedback on that essay. It can be really helpful. I was saying to students this morning, don't assume that quality is subjective, because if it is, there's no such thing as quality. So good philosophy matters as well. And unfortunately, I wouldn't agree with it. It's about the number of views. I totally agree.
Yeah, it's a proxy. Yeah, it's not always the case. It's not always.
Because I found some gems out there where they don't get the views.
Oh, that's definitely
not
true.
Yours. Yours that's is great. True. But I just mean that the other people's, like, where there's not enough attention being paid to something.
Yes, that's
so
also
also share. So when you find something good, share it with other people. Get more people involved in it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so
subscribe
much.
Subscribe to my YouTube channel.
Yeah,
well.
Do. Cosmic Skeptic. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you, guys. Yes. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for staying and missing your lunch.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Really appreciate you. Thank you. And thanks, Alex and Alex.
That brings us to the end of today's Unbelievable with Alex O'Connor and Dr. Alex Carter discussing free will. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. Do you have any questions that weren't answered today? We would love to hear from you. Visit us at premierunbelievable.com to get in touch. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please consider giving the show a follow. And remember, you can explore all of our other shows and articles on our website, which I think is going to be coming up on the screen right now, premierunbelievable.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, and see you next time.